Dr. Michael Roizen.
Dr. Michael Roizen.
You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show.
You're listening to You, the Owner's Manual Radio Podcast on Radio MD, iHeart, or wherever you download us from. Thank you for doing that. Do tell your friends about us. Do rate us. And we, as usual, are brought to you by Life's First Naturals, the makers of both Truebiotics and Bovine Colostrum. Go to their website, lifesfirstnaturals.com, to see the randomized controlled studies that show the benefits of these for those of us over the age of 50. Not in memory, but maybe in things that affect your overall well-being, whether you feel you're bloated or whether you have erosion of intestinal mucosa due to nonsteroidals such as aspirin or ibuprofen, or even if you have wanting prevention from upper respiratory infections after exercise. That's LifesFirstNaturals.com, Bovine Colostrum, and Truebiotics. And for the LongevityPlaybook.com, where you can sign up for the free newsletter once a week, gives you a summary of 250 words of the best medical news of the week related to longevity. Today, we're going to start talking about something in longevity that we've talked about before, but is really important. Now, Dr. Ranganath, and I'm probably mispronouncing his name, it's Ranganath, who's the author of Why We Remember, Unlocking Memory Power to Hold On to What Matters. It's a wonderful book, a excellent read, and comes to important conclusions. Some things I didn't understand about memory, and he is the professor of psychology and neuroscience and director of the Dynamic Memory Lab at UC Davis. And he lives in Davis. He's been recognized with a Guggenheim Fellowship and the Vannevar Bush Faculty Fellowship. And of course, he does live in that farm country, or what used to be called farm country, called Davis, California. And Dr. Ranganath, I'm trying to remember the name. In just north of Davis, there used to be a great restaurant that had a train in it that went around, and I have no memory of the name of it. And I'm saying, why did I get rid of that memory? Because we used to take our kids when we would drive from San Francisco to Tahoe. We always would stop at that restaurant on the left side of the road on Route 80 and take our kids on rides. Refresh my memory. What's the name of that restaurant, if you know it?
I've never heard of it. It's amazing. Like, the train actually moved?
Oh, yeah. The train went around. It was a train that was, you know, a fifth of the size. It fit kids in. On the other side of the, on the right side as you go up from San Francisco to Tahoe on Route 80, on the right side was a set of shops, meaning those shops developed. Those were discount shops that I think were run by one of the places that has the discount malls. But those developed because on the other side of the road was this iconic set of restaurants. It was one restaurant. They had three or four restaurants in it, but it was the key component. They had fruit groves, but you'd go throughout the fruit groves on the train. And I can't remember it for love or money now, the name. I'm sure we have some memorabilia.
I think this may have been Vacaville.
Well, it's north of Davis. It's in, I think it is in Vacaville, even north of Vacaville, actually.
Well, there's a place called Nut Tree that might be.
That was it.
Ah, okay. That's Vacaville.
The Nut Tree Restaurant.
Got it. Yeah, that's Vacaville. And so it is actually west of Davis.
So now the question is, why did my memory fail on that? And well, we should come back to the importance of what you've learned and what you are teaching us in the book. if you will, about our brains, and we forget certain things. Why do we forget certain things like that?
What's interesting about your story is that you have a remarkably rich memory for everything about it. You just couldn't pull up the name. And my guess is I could probably ask you about a couple of those meals that you actually had, and you could probably tell me something. So do you remember anything about any of your visits to this place, like any particular visit?
Oh, of course. You remember they had a great store that had items for the kitchen way before anyone else had select items for the kitchen that always worked perfectly. And I can tell you, my memory started when my parents took us there when we were adult children. And one of the things they always had was these great plates of fresh fruit with always a few nuts on it. And they had some nut trees that you wove between in the parking lot. And because it was in Vacaville in the summers, you can bet it was really hot there.
Yeah. See, you remember so much about it. So all you had trouble with was pulling up the exact name. And this is pretty characteristic of what happens to many of us. Overall, I would give you like an A- for your memory. That's really good. But, you know, these names are actually very hard. I was actually talking to Terry Gross from Fresh Air, and she was telling me, she just has tons of problems with proper names. And so after that aired, other people wrote me too, talking about their problems with proper names. So names, for whatever, well, I can tell you some reasons. Names are just one of the hardest things to remember.
And I am a medical nerd, if you will, if you'll pardon the expression. And so I remember articles, even the year they're published and the data very well. I can often remember the authors, but I can't for life of me when I meet someone in a, like I gave a talk yesterday in Nassau, the Bahamas. I know, you know, of all the people who came up to me, I can remember two or three names out of the 25 or 30 people who introduced themselves to me. So I have that problem too, but I've had it my whole life, so I don't consider it a new deficit. But why is it that when we hear somebody, when you associate it with a song, in other words, if I'm listening to a song and someone had told me, if there was a Nut Tree song, I would have remembered the Nut Tree name based on the melody. Why does music help us so much? I know I'm asking you questions that are answers that are in your book, but I want our audience to hear the answers.
So music is an extraordinary retrieval cue, meaning that it's like a song can help us pull up all sorts of information. The reasons are, one, they tend to evoke emotions. So music, I think by its nature, tends to, at least if it's a song that has a particular tune to it, it can induce a particular emotional state. And emotional states tend to be associated with better memory. So in other words, the experiences we have that are very happy or very, you know, when we're angry or scared or feeling these feelings of attachment, those are the memories that stick around. And we can even see that it's related to these release of chemicals in the brain called neuromodulators that seem to be important for allowing neuroplasticity to solidify. That's one reason why music is special. Another reason music is special is it's very distinctive. It adds something to the memory that now adds some sound as well as the just abstract information. Because names are just hard. Names are very abstract. There's nothing about your face that tells me that your name is Mike. I just have to learn this arbitrary association. And so when people say they don't remember names, it's not that they'd never heard the name Mike before and they're just totally unfamiliar to them. It's that they can't associate that name with your face. So the more you can tie in your name into something else that's catchy or distinctive, or tie it into something you know, like your knowledge of the medical literature, the better you will do.
Now, when I told a friend I was going to be interviewing you and you had written this wonderful book, which is titled Why We Remember, Unlocking Memory's Power to Hold On to What Matters, they said, I can remember facts, I can remember details, but I often, when I'm trying to find a specific word, have to use a substitute word, as my brain doesn't automatically bring up that word that I'm looking for. So if I'm looking for a word on paradox, I will have to talk about the differences between two things, but I can't remember the word paradox. And then 10 minutes later, I remember the word paradox. What's that due to? And is that the start of cognitive dysfunction, or is that just a characteristic of people as they get older related to too much information or too many memories?
Actually, it's definitely something that happens more as we get older. That's word finding problems are just totally natural as you get older. And it is also nothing to do with memory per se. It really has to do with changes in the functioning of an area called the prefrontal cortex. That it's an area of the brain that allows us to use our goals to find what we need when we need it. And as we get older, the prefrontal cortex, its functioning is not quite as efficient as it used to be. So it's not a matter of not having capacity or having too many memories in there. It's simply a matter of not being able to constrain the information you're searching for. And in particular with word finding and name finding problem, we often end up grabbing the wrong word by mistake. And once we grab the wrong word, we can't then pull up the right word because there's all this competition, because the wrong word is kind of sticking out and it keeps us. And unless we have the mental resources to suppress the wrong word in mind, we won't be able to get the right word. And as we get older, it's harder to have those mental resources. But also, if you're tired, if you're stressed out, all those factors can also make it really hard to suppress the right word and find the right word when you need it.
There are a couple of things in your book that I think stood out about memory, and then we'll get to some things that can help memory, if you will, because you go into those magnificently in the book. But let's go, if I can, to go back. You make the point that memory is inextricably linked to imagination, and that this can, in fact, lead to misinformation. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah. So one of the beautiful things about the way memory works in the brain is it's enormously economical, meaning that we don't encode this literal replay of every moment of our experience. What we do is we get the most unique and distinctive or important parts of an event. And what happens when we remember those events later on is we pull up those little fragments, the sights and the sounds, maybe that make this particular moment unique. And then we fill in the blanks in our memory with information that we already knew about. And what that allows us to do is, you know, if there's things like, let's say if you happen to go to a cafe or something like that, you don't need to form this very detailed memory of the barista making the coffee and, you know, the paying the bill and so forth, because these are things that fit in with your knowledge of what typically happens when you go to a cafe. So we often fill in the blanks with things that conform to our memory. But when we fill in the blanks, sometimes we can fill in too much and we fill in information that conforms to our beliefs. Because when we recall an event, we don't replay that event, but we really imagine how it could have been. And so our imagination sometimes gets the best of us.
So what I took from that is that we're remembering specific parts of the event, and then our mind fills in the rest of the event as we expected it had happened. Is that the right phrasing of it?
Yes, exactly, exactly. And that's why people who are fans of opposing sports teams might remember the same football match that they saw in completely different ways, or people who are in different political parties might watch a debate and come away with completely different memories of the debate and who won the debate. Because what happens is that people will reconstruct those memories based on their beliefs and their goals. And so if you believe that your person, I should say, is the best person, then that's going to color your the way you reimagine that event later on.
Now, one of the things I learned from research, I think it's from the University of Rochester, is that the longer we sleep, the more we shrink our brain, if you will, dehydrate it a little since we aren't drinking it at night, drinking water at night, drinking fluids, and that that gets rid of waste products created in the brain when we're actively using it. But we're actively using it at night, too, to recreate events. Tell us how that works, if you would.
One of the interesting things about sleep is just the sheer amount of important activities that take place during sleep. So I think many of us would look at sleep and say, ah, that's wasted time that I'm sleeping. If only I could just be awake more and sleep less, I would be getting more done. But it's quite the opposite. So one of the main functions in sleep apparently seems to be for the brain to get rid of a lot of the waste that accumulates. So for instance, amyloid proteins that have been implicated in Alzheimer's disease, there's a whole system that's been recently discovered called the glymphatic system, which just flushes out that amyloid that accumulates over the course of the day, which might be why people who, as you get older, you get less sleep, and that might be related to why amyloid tends to accumulate more. But there's other functions of sleep. So if you actually record electrical activity in the brain, there's many different stages of sleep. It goes, the two big ones would be REM sleep or rapid eye movement sleep, where you're having dreams, for instance, and what's called slow wave sleep, which is when you're in this very, very deep state of sleep. And so the electrical activity in the brain during these two states is very different. What we know is that memories for events that occurred during previous days, the neurons that were active during those experiences get reactivated during sleep. And this seems to play a role in being able to hold on to memories for some of those events, but also to be able to link up each event and pull out the big picture of what happened, right? So if I were to see you in two or three different contexts, in two or three different events, at some point through sleep, my brain could figure out what makes Mike tick. And it allows me to figure out something that goes beyond any individual event to some deeper understanding of you. Does that make sense?
Yes. Although I was going to ask you a different question, I've got to just put a comment in. Maybe I should figure out that better, because essentially what we do in our executive health practice at the Cleveland Clinic and in our wellness practice is try and find the motivator for patients. That is what makes them tick, because we play on that to get behavior change. I never thought about it, my brain doing that subconsciously while I'm not working to help me figure that out at some other time. I will have to think more about that. But one of the things that you go into in the book, and we're talking with Charan, Charan Raghunath, and I'm mispronouncing that name, so I apologize. He is the author of a brilliant book, Why We Remember, Unlocking Memory's Power to Hold On to What Matters, published by Doubleday. But you talk about both sleep and exercise, as well as diet and, of course, avoiding what I call unforced errors, smoking. But when I was talking to this friend that I was interviewing you with, I was talking to him yesterday, and he's the one who said he couldn't get the right word at sometimes. But he said, look, when we were both physicians, we debated whether it was better to sleep or exercise, because we didn't have enough time to do both. Ask him which is more important for memory, if you can. In other words, is it better to sacrifice sleep in order to exercise, or should you always get the right amount of sleep and fit exercise in only occasionally? And so I promised him I would ask you that question as well.
It's really hard to say, because first of all, it depends on what kind of exercise we're even talking about. Are we talking about aerobic exercise? Are we talking about, you know, weight training, for instance? And then we're also in the realm of trying to figure out Well, how much sleep is enough sleep? I know Matt Walker, who's a sleep scientist, he's a friend of mine. He has ideas about this, but I think that there's a lot of individual differences. I mean, I think this is one of the big gaps, which as a physician, I'm sure you can relate to, that we have in the science of the brain, is that we don't know how and why individuals differ from each other. Some people seem to respond much more to exercise than others. And some people seem to need more sleep than others, but we don't know enough about that variability. Essentially, we don't even know how much of the variability exists, let alone what drives it. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Almost all of us in medicine in the olden days, that's when the nut tree was really prominent, meaning in the 80s and 90s, sacrificed a lot of sleep for work. As you may know, I've written 22 books for the lay audience with four number ones, but the first one was Real Age, and I was a department chair at the University of Chicago while I was writing it. So I was working literally 110 hours a week because of this. And my wife said, "Why are you trying to kill yourself?" And of course, I said, because I think I've got something that can change the health of America. But the point that I'm making is that all of us in the olden days in medicine would sacrifice sleep for either patient care or almost every other activity. It doesn't happen anyplace near as much anymore. But I wonder is, did it lead to, or would you have suspected it led to early one or other forms of dementia in the physician group? And do physicians develop dementia? I mean, there probably is a cognitive reserve story, but do physicians develop, or did physicians in the older eras where we sacrifice sleep, develop dementia at an increasing rate compared to the rest of the population?
Oh, man, I don't even know if there's any data on separating physicians from non-physicians. It's actually a great natural experiment, right? Because as you point out, during medical training, there's so much sleep deprivation that takes place. And what we know is that there are other changes in lifestyle habits. It's actually, when you compare young people now to older adults, there are some big lifestyle differences that go even beyond sleep, right? So it's really hard for me to say. I wish I could give you a more useful answer, but I just don't know.
Well, I'm glad your book has stimulated so many questions. One of the thoughts I wanted to get out on the book is you talk about the default mode and why it's a key to early detection of Alzheimer's. Tell us what the default mode is.
So we used to talk about the brain as if it was a series of separate areas that are each doing their own thing, right? So imagine I'm working my way through some government bureaucracy and one person after another is handling the paperwork. Now what we've started to realize is that the brain is organized into networks, meaning that there's groups of areas that are working at very high levels that are cooperating to process high-level information. And so the default mode network was the set of areas that was identified because these areas were pretty active when people go into their heads. And what I mean by that could be something as simple as daydreaming or just zoning out, so to speak. But it's also active when people are remembering, or it's active while people are imagining things that could happen in the future. It's active when people are planning, when people even play video games where they navigate in virtual reality or when they watch movies. And so we started to become interested in this network because essentially, when people are, well, one of the reasons is in Alzheimer's disease, it is the network that gets hit first in the brain. So there's an area of the brain called the entorhinal cortex, which is part of the system around the hippocampus, which is an area that everybody talks about as being important for memory. But the next stage is that you start to see buildup of amyloid protein throughout this network of areas called the default network. And then there's also atrophy that happens where you start to see cell loss. And so these areas seem to be kind of like a pathway of destruction where you have some kinds of misbehaving proteins that just travel through this network causing cell death. At least that's the story. And so what we've been trying to do in my lab is come up with ways of identifying how can we track the functions of the default mode network, because we know that dysfunction in the default mode network seems to happen even before people develop the noticeable symptoms of Alzheimer's disease. That is, even before clinicians start to notice that there's memory problems. And so that's why if we can identify people ahead of time, before they start to show clinically significant memory problems, that's where if you wanted to give drugs, if you wanted to administer some kind of behavioral interventions, that's the point at which you can really make a difference. Once people have memory problems, there's already been so much brain damage that really it's just a matter of damage control at this point, but in slowing the progression.
And how does one identify that problem in the default network? In other words, are people who are developing this, do they stop imagining things? Do they stop daydreaming? Is there any what we might call simple way of identifying who's whom?
Right now, the way in which people have identified preclinical Alzheimer's disease, where you start to see this accumulation of amyloid, for instance, in the default network, they use PET scanning, which is a very invasive and very expensive approach where you use these radioactive tracers. Now there's other techniques like plasma tests that are being used that show some degree of promise. But then beyond that, we don't have a whole lot. But what we're trying to do in my lab is to develop behavioral methods and to really ask people, for instance, to remember stories, because one of the things about remembering stories is it really involves this degree of imagination and reconstruction of the past. And so we're seeing already that there do seem to be some differences between pathological aging and non-pathological aging in terms of that ability to remember stories. But it's still early stages and we don't know if it's enough. What we do know is that there's these fascinating points when people are remembering stories or even when they're experiencing things in life called event boundaries. And these are points where mental context shifts from one way to another. So if I were all of a sudden to just change the topic of this conversation, or if you were to just zone out because you got bored of me and start looking at your phone, there would be this shift in a pattern of activity in the default mode network, and that would be called an event boundary. And at those points in time, that seems to be when the memory system encodes memories for events. So we've found that these spikes in activity that you have throughout the hippocampus and default mode network happen at event boundaries, and those spikes go down with age, meaning that there's less of an abrupt shift at the event boundaries. And what we also see is, independent of age, that this seems to be a biomarker of memory, meaning that people who have lower spikes in activity at these points are also performing more poorly on tests of memory. And so this is our candidate biomarker that we're going for in our research.
Thank you very much. The book is just outstanding, and you should be applauded for it. It's called Why We Remember: Unlocking Memory's Power to Hold On to What Matters. It's published by Doubleday. It's available on Amazon, and hopefully you'll go to your local independent bookstore as well to think about fostering their success as well. The author and our guest today, Sharon Ranganath, Ranganath. Thank you, the listeners, 50,000 of you. We can't be wrong. Thank you for downloading us. Thank you. And do tell your friends about us and rate us. And as usual, we're brought to you by longevityplaybook.com, where you can go to sign up for the free newsletter, 250 words of wisdom on longevity, plus a comic to help you stay healthier, as well as lifesfirstnaturals.com, the makers of both Truebiotics and Bovine Colostrum. Do consider those for yourself. Thanks again. We'll see you next week. Again, Why We Remember, Unlocking Memory's Power to Hold On to What Matters. Not only does he go into what is memory and how it's formed and all of the aspects of it, but also what you can do to increase it. Thanks again.